You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Trump administration says it's hopeful that Congress will pass the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal this fall, but Democrats and labor unions say not so fast. We'll get two Wisconsin takes on that deal coming up. Now, the number of severe storms in northwestern Wisconsin seems to be growing and getting more intense along the way, dumping a lot of rain on the region. That's caused problems in the last few years for a lot of the region's local communities who are trying to rebuild damaged infrastructure to deal with more rain, also trying to work within the limitations of their budgets. Our partners at WisContext recently spent some time in the area looking at how places are coping with these changes. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. His latest piece at WisContext.org is titled Washed Away, Northwest Wisconsin Copes with the Costs of a Changing Climate. Will, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, remind us of the storms we've seen just over the last handful of years in this part of the state.
Sure. There was a really pretty intense storm in 2012 that affected northeastern Minnesota a little bit more than Wisconsin. But that storm really affected Douglas County and especially the city of Superior and also some parts of Bayfield County. And then there was a really bad storm in July 2016 that affected a wide swath of northwestern Wisconsin from the Minnesota border all the way to the border of the UP. That dumped up to 10 inches of rain in a lot of places. The Bad River, which drains into Lake Superior, reached peak stream flows in 15 hours, stream flows that were like almost twice as high as the previous record. And then there was another flood in 2018 that hit a lot of the same places that were hit in 2016.
And each of these did quite a bit of damage, right, to the extent that it's not all fixed yet.
Yes, quite a lot of damage, especially to road infrastructure. Washed out roads as a result of failed culverts pretty often.
We hear phrases sometimes like 100-year flood, 500-year flood, 1,000-year flood. We don't need to dig exactly into the probability here, but 100-year flood doesn't mean if it happened this year, it's not going to happen again for a century.
Yeah, it can be confusing. Those terms are kind of confusing, especially when each of those floods in 2012, 2016, and 2018 were variously, in some places, considered a 100 or a 500 or even a 1,000-year flood. So that doesn't mean that those storms are only expected to recur every 100 or 500 or 1,000 years. It just means that the probability, for instance, of a 100-year storm hitting in any given location in a single year is 1%. So that means that it could hit 2 years in a row.
Now, a big point, a big piece of the story you wrote, and we'll be talking about this more with our next guest, is the infrastructure in place, culverts, road preparedness, a lot of other things not ready for this kind of intensity of rainfall.
Right. The local governments are responsible for maintaining roads, especially counties and the townships. And for decades, they've been following precipitation guidelines. They usually build roads to kind of a 100-year flood standard. And they've been following guidelines that seem to be pretty out of date. And some townships also haven't even been hitting those guidelines, basically because of cost. Culverts can be pretty expensive once they get bigger. Recently it was found out that, for instance, in Ashland, the amount of precipitation that's expected in a quote-unquote 100-year storm is actually about 35% greater than was previously understood. So even the townships that were installing culverts that were quote-unquote properly sized for a 100-year storm in the region weren't actually prepared for what was possible.
Talking to Will Cushman from WisContext about his piece on flooding in northern Wisconsin, recent floods over the last few years, and communities trying to prepare for the next one. As part of that, Will, okay, we have culverts being overrun, destroyed. Communities want to build them more in line with the flooding that they're worried about. What happens when they go to FEMA for funding to do that?
Right. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? If a culvert fails and destroys a road because there was too much rainwater flowing through it and backing up, you'd want to build a larger culvert. That makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, when a local community gets FEMA funding, often what FEMA requires is that they rebuild that infrastructure in kind, meaning that they have to rebuild it as it was prior to the disaster. And when the infrastructure is inadequate for the rainstorms that have been hitting the region, rebuilding it as it was before just is pretty impractical, but that is often the decision that communities have to face. Either go it alone, and a lot of them don't. Most townships and counties are struggling with funding, especially for roads, or go to FEMA and have to follow their rules and rebuild in kind.
You talked to local officials in the northwestern Wisconsin region. Did you get a sense of frustration with that? That one piece of the puzzle.
Very much so. I think people did acknowledge the help. I mean, FEMA has been tremendously helpful in a lot of ways in helping fund rebuilding of infrastructure. But yes, definitely talk to chairs of townships and county highway commissioners who have been pretty frustrated by the FEMA rules. Some of the more tenacious ones have been able to negotiate with FEMA to allow some upgrades to infrastructures, install some larger culverts that can handle more stormwater. But really, it's difficult to get that go-ahead from FEMA and really requires a lot of back-and-forth negotiation.
Let's look at the role of climate change. I know you can't generally look at one storm and say this was a climate change storm. But
right.
Is it the sense when you talk to experts on this that it's loading the dice a little bit? It's making the freak event a bit less freaky over time.
Yeah. What's expected in the region with climate change and in the upper Midwest generally is more frequent, intense, extreme precipitation, kind of like the events that northwestern Wisconsin has seen in 2012, 2016, and 2018. So communities are fully expecting for events like this to recur in the future, for sure.
So what sense do you get from local officials up there as they're still trying to clean up from the past? They're trying to plan for this future where these storms are going to be more likely, probably. And as you said, they're not carrying around bags of money adequate to deal with this. Talk about the position they're in.
Yeah, some of them kind of described feeling a sense of almost like PTSD when there's a big – like a thunderstorm in the forecast, kind of this sense of impending potential doom, like just knowing that the majority or a good portion of the infrastructure, even the infrastructure that's been rebuilt, could potentially not withstand another storm like they've seen in the last few years. So I think there's really a sense of anxiety in some of these communities. But I think in some places also some optimism that they have been able to upgrade enough culverts or maybe strategically upgrade some stream crossings, road crossings to make the region at least a little bit more resilient to these major storms.
As we wrap up, we'll talk to somebody who's been studying this in just a few minutes, but do you see efforts at the state level or federal level to help these local communities boost what you just said, their resilience in the face of flooding?
Yeah, especially I think at the federal level right now, there is a bill in the U.S. Senate co-sponsored by Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin that would require the Department of Transportation to consider resilience in disaster grants. So this would be like the Federal Highway Administration. So to consider the resilience in improving resilience in a project that's funded by those grant monies. Not sure how that would affect how FEMA goes about what it does after a disaster, but there is at least talk at the federal level of being a little bit more practical about how we rebuild after a disaster.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Will Cushman, Associate Editor of WisContext. Coming up next, we'll hear from one of the first environmental scientists in northwestern Wisconsin to raise concerns about how prepared the region was for more intense flooding. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived through one or two or three of these massive storms and the flooding that they brought? If you live in an area where flooding is a risk, in northwestern Wisconsin or other parts of the state, is your community ready for these kind of storms in the future? What do you want to see yourself do to get more prepared? We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about how northwestern Wisconsin is responding to the growing frequency and intensity of storms and the flooding that often follows. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is you and your life, you've seen these floods and storms close up. What was it like dealing with the damage to local roads and bridges? Do you have experience working with FEMA? What questions do you have about ways your community can get better prepared for future storms? Are you in local government in a community that's been hit by flooding? Love to hear your perspective. Call 800-642-1234. Randy Lair joins us now, former environmental scientist at Northland College in Ashland. He's now dean of math and science at Sierra College in California. Randy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, back in 2014, Randy, you said the Shawamigan Bay was arguably the, and I'm quoting here, least climate-adapted spot in the country from an infrastructure standpoint. What did you mean by that?
Well, when I made that comment, we were looking at some of these historical rainfalls. And so the National Weather Service for a long time had produced a data set that gave information to engineers to get a sense of how big they should build culverts and bridges at different road crossings. Every time a road crosses a stream, they want to know how much rain falls on the land upstream so they can get a sense of how big the culvert needs to be or how big the bridge needs to be. And it turned out that the data they were using back in the 1960s wasn't matching up with some of the things that they were seeing on the ground. And so NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, started to update these data. And when they did that, they found out that there were some places where the new estimates were wildly different than the old numbers that were out there. And one of those places was Shawamigan Bay. And so the communities throughout the Shawamigan Bay area, the new numbers were saying that it was raining somewhere between, you know, maybe 20 to 45% more now than it used to be. And so what had been happening was, you know, engineers had been designing and building road crossings with these old data for a really long time. And it turns out that after we looked at things a little more finely, they were undersized and so prone to this kind of washout. And if you look at those differences, the 35 and 45% differences, those stood out across the country that had been studied at the time as some of the greatest differences. And so that was what prompted me to make that statement.
We got a call from Robert in Winchester, broadening the perspective here a little bit. He wanted to ask about the impact of deforestation in northern Wisconsin and how that affects flooding and lake levels. And I understand, Randy, that changes in forests and wetlands are part of the story here.
Yeah, definitely. So there's kind of two parts to the equation, you know, how much rain is coming down and then how much of that rain actually makes its way into the streams. And so there are different parts of the state that had been clear-cut significantly in the turn of the century. And what you see is that if you change the vegetation, a higher percentage of the rainfall ends up running off. So some of these historical land practices had kind of predisposed the landscape to be a little bit more flood prone than it would have been otherwise. So you combine that with more intense rainfalls and undersized infrastructure, and you kind of have a few different factors converging there.
You mentioned runoff, and a lot of people focus understandably on, you know, the washed out roads, the washed out houses, things like that. This all ends up ultimately in Lake Superior, right? Can you talk about what happens after these larger than expected floods and runoff in the lake itself?
Yeah, it's really quite striking if you're ever up in the area after one of these big rainstorms. Basically, the whole near shore area, so the waters right next to the shoreline of Lake Superior, turn this kind of vivid red color that's all the clay that has washed off the land and gotten into the lake. And so the clarity of the lake is usually, you can see down 30, 40 feet in some cases. And when it gets really murky, you can only see down a couple of inches. You put your hand in the water and you can't see it anymore. And, you know, there's all sorts of other ramifications, different pollutants washing into the water. But we start to see that having impacts on water quality in Lake Superior, effects on fisheries, and so on.
One piece you wrote raised a couple of what ifs. There was a proposed big iron mine in the region and more recently a proposed large-scale animal farm in the region. Those weren't there for the flooding. What kind of worries would you have for projects like those if they were there?
Yeah, well, I think that was one of the big what-if questions that we were wrestling with. And so these large-scale development projects are guided in how they have to deal with rainfall and stormwater by different parts of the administrative code. And the administrative code in Wisconsin really hasn't been thoroughly updated to reflect our new understanding of rainfall intensity. So had those two large-scale developments been built, they would have been required by law to use data that were already outdated outdated to design manure storage or mine tailing waste ponds to treat water quality or to improve water quality. And it's, you know, it's a big what-if scenario, but the question that presents itself is, had these facilities been built with outdated standards and we would have gotten these big rainstorms on top of them, what would have happened? You know, would the facilities have held, or would the, you know, manure ponds and mine tailing ponds have washed out, just like we saw much of the other undersized infrastructure wash out? And I think there were a lot of, it was a very tenuous public debate around these different facilities, and it sort of intersects with a lot of this, these changing precipitation patterns and undersized infrastructure.
Talking to Randy Lair, formerly from Northland College in Ashland, now with Sierra College in California, talking about flooding in Wisconsin, northwestern Wisconsin in particular, as a case study. Bigger rains, more of them, overwhelming local communities' infrastructure meant to deal with now outdated predictions of what a big rainfall could be. Randy, has this series of storms, you think, been a wake-up call? Does this have people actually trying to fix this thing before the next big storm?
Definitely. You know, I think the local governments are really keyed in on this and doing what they can to update facilities and try to prepare and prevent the impacts of other such storms into the future. But, you know, as your last guest was talking about, there are some limitations in the way that FEMA funds can be used to replace washed out road crossings. You know, most of these communities are in very rural areas, and so they just don't have a lot of funding to go in and preemptively upgrade or increase the size of road crossings. So I think they're keyed in at the local level and doing everything they can. One of the areas that things have lagged behind a little bit that I alluded to is we really haven't updated our administrative code throughout the state. Other states throughout the region, Minnesota, for example, took these new rainfall estimates and, you know, 7-8 years ago now, updated the requirements for engineering design and construction projects to incorporate our new understanding or updated understanding of rainfall. And Wisconsin just hasn't done that in a thorough way at this point in time. So we're a little bit behind the curve there, I would say.
Are there more or less universal lessons that local governments, local communities can take to say, yeah, we want to be more flood resilient given this changing storm landscape?
Yeah, I think there's two different ways to approach that. You know, one of the ways that FEMA funds can be accessible to upgrade, say you a small culvert washed out and you wanted to replace it with a larger culvert, if you do the design work ahead of time and you know based on some scientific assessment that, yep, the culvert that's in there right now is too small, when we replace it, we should replace it with a larger one. If those types of studies have been done ahead of time, FEMA has a mitigation process where they allow you to put in a larger culvert. But, you know, doing that sort of in the heat of the moment after you've had a large scale disaster in a county is really difficult. And so the more that type of planning can be done on the front end, the easier it is to use some of these federal dollars to upgrade infrastructure. The other thing that the region is doing quite a lot of is on the ground projects to try to slow the flow of water across the landscape is sort of the lingo that people use. And that's doing things like putting in rain gardens or constructed wetlands or things like that to trap more of the runoff or slow it down before it gets into the stream. So if there's less water that comes, that gets into a stream after a big rainstorm, then the size of the infrastructure you need to build can be proportionally less. And there's a lot of attention being paid to that in the south shore of Lake Superior right now.
Okay, are we counting on this county government and this small city and this township and so this village to each come up with their own solutions? Or are you seeing, or do we need more coordinated efforts from at the state level or federal level?
Yeah, I think it's going to take cooperation across all levels. I think most of this is being driven by the local level governments right now. They're the ones that are having to deal with this most intimately. But we're starting to see some traction at both the state and federal level. But I think really to you know get the ball across the goal line, it's going to take, you know, sort of a large scale cooperative effort.
Northwestern Wisconsin isn't the only part of the state or the region, obviously, to feel the effects of flooding. Do you think that places that haven't seen big flooding yet are taking this seriously, or does it take having that overwhelming flood to get local leaders to get on board with doing something here?
Yeah, that certainly increases people's attention to the concerns. But other places have looked at other modifications. So a number of years ago, the Greater Chicago area actually went through and developed their own rainfall data to guide their infrastructure development. So they had kind of been seeing changes in precipitation patterns and, you know, undertook a region-wide study to figure out, well, how should we be designing our infrastructure? So we have seen some very progressive approaches to that, but definitely, when you see the disaster, that really gets people's attention, unfortunately.
I talked to Will Cushman earlier a little bit about how climate change plays into all of this. What do you see as when it comes to climate change and a risk of flooding?
Yeah. I mean, like you had talked about earlier, you can't really ever attribute one storm to climate change. It's more the trend, more the trajectory. But one of the interesting and maybe disturbing things about the region is that in most cases in northern Wisconsin over the last 50 years, the state had actually been in pretty significant drought, with the exception of the Shawangan Bay area. The amount and the intensity of precipitation had actually been increasing over the last 50 plus years, while the rest of northern Wisconsin was actually drier and drier. And so there's a lot of questions about, will that continue to increase into the future? And sort of our region-wide studies suggest that it will. The degree to which that happens and the timing over which that happens is a little unclear, but the trends seem like they're all lining up.
Well, and the fear is that we're going to see more extremes, so we might see unusually long droughts and then unusually intense rainfalls. We could see them going back and forth.
Exactly. That's the concern, is that you'd have, intermittent periods of drought and flooding, which is sort of both extremes. Neither one of them is particularly good.
If you were consulted by state lawmakers, Randy, what would you tell them should be their top priority when it comes to getting ready for these more intense storms?
I think the easiest thing, the first thing to do, is to look at the administrative code to make sure that the required design standards are meeting or are aligned with our newest understanding of rainfall patterns. They're just not right now. And the other thing, I think, is to look at some of these cooperative efforts. There's been some work at the federal level now to introduce some bills to try to look at resiliency and to look at ways in which the federal and state efforts can be aligned to accelerate some of this adaptation and resiliency planning.
Randy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Randy Lair, formerly with Northland College in Ashland, now Dean of Math and Science at Sierra College in California. He's with us today to talk about how local communities can plan for better infrastructure in light of heavier storms, especially recently in northwestern Wisconsin. If you want to hear more about WisContext reporting on the impact of flooding in northwestern Wisconsin, tune into Here and Now tomorrow night at 7:30 or 11:30 on Wisconsin Public Television, or read about it online at wiscontext.org. Congress is currently on its August recess. It isn't scheduled to be back until the week after Labor Day. One of the issues it'll have to deal with this fall is the new trade deal between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, the one that would replace the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. The leaders of the three countries agreed to the deal last year, but it has to be approved by the legislatures as well. Mexico is good to go. The Canadian Parliament is working on it, but it's also on recess. The Trump administration says it's hopeful Congress will pass it, but Democrats and labor unions are hoping to see some changes first. We've got two Wisconsin-based perspectives on how lawmakers should proceed. Kurt Bauer is president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Kurt, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Good to see you.
And David Newby is the president of the Wisconsin Fair Trade Coalition, former president of Wisconsin's AFL-CIO. David, thanks for coming up to the studio today.
Great to be here, Rob.
Kurt, let's start with you. You wrote an opinion piece in the Cap Times calling for Congress to ratify this deal. Make the case for it.
Well, we are a manufacturing state. We're an agricultural state, and we make and grow things that need to be, have markets. And Canada and Mexico are by far our largest markets. About half of what we export go to those two markets. And those are growing markets for us, particularly on the dairy side of things. Here in Wisconsin, of course, we've got a crisis in dairy, and the last thing we want to do is make it worse by ruining a relationship that we have with Mexico, right now the number one source of purchasing of exported dairy products. So from our perspective, we're a manufacturing state, we're an agricultural state, we want to make it here, we want to grow it here, and we want to sell it there.
And David, you had a response in the Cap Times saying the deal isn't all it's cracked up to be. What don't you like about the what's being called the USMCA?
Well, what Kirk just said is basically correct. However, the deal that's being proposed would not change that significantly at all. And in fact, in some ways would make it worse that we have under NAFTA. What Kurt is doing is essentially contrasting the newly negotiated deal with having no trade agreement at all. That's not going to happen. Given the supply chains that have developed under NAFTA, that is going to continue. What we need to do is to take the opportunity of this renegotiation to make it really work for workers and farmers and families themselves, instead of having a corporate-dominated deal that benefits really only the multinational corporations and big corporate agriculture.
But, David, I mean, President Trump seemed to be very open to the, okay, no deal at all possibility as this thing was being negotiated. It did seem like a realistic alternative that we'd end up with not a deal at all.
Very, very unlikely. And I think Kurt will or should agree that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example, has lobbied very heavily against simply canceling NAFTA. Now, Trump, you know, will probably publicly use that as a hammer on Congress, but the reality is that the business community itself is extremely set against that. They have already begun heavy lobbying against that, as well as for passage of the deal as is. And have also told the president that his support from big business and the corporate community is at risk if he actually considers seriously canceling NAFTA.
Now, Kurt, what do you see as an improvement in the USMCA as compared to NAFTA that makes it worth not just letting NAFTA ride?
I think the biggest aspect, NAFTA is 25 years old now. We're looking at a modernization. I think it provides a stronger, better, clearer rules for all parties involved. There have been some enforcement issues that have been denoted by our members. I think that this addresses them to some extent, although there's always challenges with trade deals, as we're seeing enforcement challenges with China. We don't have a trade deal with China, but you get the point. There's always challenges there. Bottom line is that we need to update a trade agreement that I think worked very well for the United States, certainly in Wisconsin's benefit. Wisconsin did very well under NAFTA. And again, you know, we're looking at our number one and number two trading partners, almost half of our overall trading relationship. So it's important to keep that up to date. It's important to modernize it.
Kurt, to David's point about labor standards, a concern leading up to NAFTA, since NAFTA, has been that if we don't do something about labor standards in Mexico, wages in Mexico, some communities will be hit hard by the loss of manufacturing jobs. There seems to be some evidence that that has happened. Even if overall the deal has helped Americans, there are places that have been hurt. Would it have been worth looking more into those issues for the USMCA?
Well, there are two ways to look at it. So you look at it from the Mexican perspective. Again, this is an update of what we had in the previous arrangement. I think, though, you're looking at Mexico's a different economy. They're a developed economy, but they're not as strong as the United States and Canada. This trade agreement will maybe address some of that, but we can't, through a trade agreement, make their economy exactly like ours, increase wages just like ours. I think that that's a folly to try and do that. They do have a new administration down in Mexico City. The new president, who's left-leaning, just enacted some new labor laws down there that will be codified in USMCA. And then from the American perspective, the best way to protect and grow U.S.-based manufacturing is to find markets for the products that we produce here, and USMCA does that.
Talking to Kurt Bauer from Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce and David Newby with the Wisconsin Fair Trade Coalition, formerly president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, looking at congressional approval of the NAFTA replacement, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, still waiting for approval in Congress. David, what opportunities did you see in this process to change labor standards in Mexico, possibly to the benefit of American workers?
Well, let's take the issue of labor standards. There are some improvements in this agreement. For example, the requirement that Mexico reform its labor law to essentially outlaw company unions, which have been dominant in Mexico for decades. and they have preempted an independent labor movement that would have some ability to help raise wages and improve working conditions. That is good, and Mexico has, in fact, come through on their commitment. They have changed their law. But now the question is, will it be enforced? And unfortunately, the U.S.-Mexico Canada agreement does not include effective enforcement or monitoring provisions. There are discussions going on in Washington about making changes to what has been negotiated that would help a lot. But most folks, I think, don't realize that manufacturing wages in Mexico are actually a notch less than they are in China. So we, in effect, have China right on our border in terms of manufacturing. It's impossible for American workers to compete with those wage levels. We need very strong labor laws in Mexico. We could have some improvements here, too, which would be great. We're very much overdue. But in Mexico, we need those improvements so that Mexican workers themselves can organize and raise their wages so that we have more of a level playing field in terms of the cost of production between the United States and Mexico.
Kurt, do you see room for tweaks like what David is talking about?
Well, certainly there's, as long as all three parties agree to it, but that's a complication at this point because, you know, the trade negotiators worked on this and it was contentious, of course, and now it's before Ottawa and Washington. Mexico City has already passed it. So I think at the 11th hour, that would require Mexico to reconvene, and that is always a complicating factor. I think, though, Dave is not giving the American manufacturing industry enough credit. I mean, we are growing manufacturing jobs in the United States. We certainly are in Wisconsin. Our biggest problem right now is that we don't have enough workers for the jobs that we have. I mean, we have a lot of advantages to producing in the United States. We've got the intellectual property protections. We've got the innovations, the world leading R&D. We've got a very stable political and economic environment. We've got a high-skilled labor force. We've got the strong K-16 institutions, post-secondary, and, of course, proximity to supply chains. And, of course, if we have trade deals, you know, that's another advantage that the U.S. economy has. We're the largest economy in the world, and when we have these deals, you know, those countries get access to our markets, and, of course, we get access to theirs as well.
David, the case of manufacturing looking pretty good in the United States. Nothing needs fixing here.
Well, it has been documented by the government itself that we have lost well over 45,000 jobs, good family-supporting jobs in Wisconsin alone, about 1 million jobs nationally since NAFTA was approved. And NAFTA has had the effect, because of that low-wage competition, of keeping American manufacturing wages pretty much even. There's been basically no increase once you adjust for inflation. There's been no increase in the buying power of manufacturing workers' wages ever since NAFTA was passed. We need to change that. And working families need those changes so that they can improve their standard of living, which ought to be happening because the value of what they produce has increased dramatically. But that new value has gone entirely to investors and to capital, and the workers themselves have not seen the benefits of that increased value of production.
Talking about whether Congress should approve the new trade deal between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Both of our guests have written about that issue in the Cap Times. Kurt Bauer, president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and David Newby, president of the Wisconsin Fair Trade Coalition, former president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. How about you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Congress approve this revision to NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, make the case for or against it? Are you a farmer or a manufacturer or a worker in one of those two fields who depends on exports to or from Canada and Mexico? What do you think of this deal? Do you think there need to be changes to our free trade agreements with our neighbors to the north and south? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about what the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement could mean for Wisconsin. Our guests are David Newby, president of the Wisconsin Fair Trade Coalition, former president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, Kurt Bauer, also with us, president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. You can read their thoughts on this a little more over at the Cap Times. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Congress sign off on this revision to NAFTA? What worries do you have when it comes to trade with our neighbors in Canada and Mexico? What does it mean for you here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Kurt, we've focused on manufacturing for the most part so far. What other areas do you point to when it comes to the U.S. MCA agreement that you see as a big improvement over NAFTA as it stands now?
Well, again, I think it updates a antiquated NAFTA, 25 years old. The world has changed a lot. The economies have changed a lot. That what we're exporting to Mexico and Canada is a little bit different. That's particularly true, as I indicated earlier, with dairy. Since NAFTA was enacted, dairy has become a major exporter to Mexico, something that's growing and something that we want to see continue.
And what areas outside of manufacturing, David, are you focusing in on?
Well, let me first say that in terms of any kind of economic growth, the International Trade Commission, which is an independent federal agency that is required to do an economic analysis of any proposed new trade agreement, they came out with their report back in April. And in terms of economic growth, they have predicted that this new agreement, if there are no changes at all, will increase our gross national product by 0.35% over 6 years. Now, that is basically nothing. It's about $68 billion in 6 years versus our national economy that produces $19 trillion every single year. So in terms of economic growth, it's really not going to make any difference. The other area that we're very concerned about is an area that should not be in the agreement at all, and that is special protections for the drug industry, for pharmaceutical firms, and particularly with regard to these new biologic drugs that are based not on chemicals, but they're actually organically produced. Those are the ones you see advertised on television at night. They're usually incredibly expensive. And for some reason, in this agreement, pharma, the big lobby pharma, was able to get into the proposed agreement a 10-year prohibition against any kind of generic competition. Now, that means that Congress, which has said for both parties and the president that they want to do something about high drug prices, one of the things that has been talked about is reducing the number of years where patents can be in effect and keep generics off the market. If this agreement is passed the way it's been negotiated, that will tie the hands of Congress and give basically lock in the extremely high prices and profits of these new biologic drugs. There's no reason why that should be in an agreement like this. It ought to come out, and that's one of the changes that needs to be renegotiated. Renegotiating is not a problem. Every major agreement that we've had in the last 10, 15 years has gone back to the parties for changes once Congress has seen and analyzed what's actually in the proposed agreement. So that should be no different in this agreement. Those changes can be affected, whether it's the labor standards or whether it's getting these protections for the drug industry out of there.
Kurt, do you see that as a possibility, whether it's the drug industry or other issues, the idea that Congress could give it a look and maybe get it renegotiated?
Well, as I said earlier, I think that that's problematic because this was hammered out over a long period of time, you know, three nations getting together and working out an agreement and then having to go back to the drawing board. I mean, there's always a possibility that the deal could get worse from that perspective. I think that this is, by and large, a very good deal for Wisconsin, for the United States, and I think that we ought to enact it as is. To David's point, though, about the pharmaceuticals, it's not a big area of expertise, but as I understand it, it's that provision is designed to be a protection for U.S.-based pharmaceuticals, which, of course, are the world leader in life-saving, life-altering drugs, so that they have protections on their intellectual property to recoup, the billions of dollars in investment and the decades long it takes to bring a product to market. So, if that is in fact the case, I think that that is a fair and logical protection for U.S. pharmaceuticals.
Talking about the USMCA agreement, Congress expected to take it up when they come back in a session. We've got Kurt Bauer from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce with us. Also, David Newby, former president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. I want to bring in a caller or two. Lou is with us in Bessemer, Michigan. Lou, hi.
Hey there. I was just telling your call screener that I was a tool and die maker for 40 years. When NAFTA was first brought in, the big rush was China. I mean, we were international, but at that time we weren't. But we ran to China. We found people that would work for 70 cents an hour, or it wasn't even that at the time, and where we were paying them 12 bucks an hour at a press there in Maquanago. Then we went to Mexico, and we found out we could get them cheap too. So they play this global playing of one another, and it's always been. I'd like to ask Mr. Newby, does he think that labor ever gets a fair shot or a spot at the table at any of these negotiations? Because I've watched it all these years, and
Lou, I'm going to jump in because we don't have too much time, and I want to get both David Newby and Kurt Bauer in on that. David, he asked you first, I guess.
Well, there is a labor advisory committee that has been very much involved in these negotiations. Unfortunately, in the areas of labor standards, environmental standards, where there are problems very similar to what I outlined for labor, and the area of pharmaceutical drugs, the advice of the Labor Advisory Committee was ignored, and that has been very frustrating because people really thought that this time labor would get a fair shake and we could make the changes necessary to make this agreement work for workers. But unfortunately, their advice was ignored, and that's why we have to go back to that advice and get these changes made.
And Kurt, Lou saying, hey, skilled workers like him were losers in effect in NAFTA, cheaper labor found in other countries. What would you say to workers in that position?
Well, manufacturing is a lot different than it was back in 1994 when we passed NAFTA. Manufacturing in the United States and certainly in Wisconsin is advanced manufacturing. Simple, processes are gone. Much of them have been automated. They're not likely to come back to the United States unless they can be automated. So we focus on the fact that we're an advanced manufacturing country. We're still the world's largest manufacturer. Wisconsin, the largest economic sector, is by far manufacturing, 20% of Wisconsin GDP, almost 500,000 people working in manufacturing. So manufacturing still thrives today, but it looks a lot different. It's the information age meets the industrial age. So it's a lot more computers, and there's going to be a lot more robotics in the future.
Just a few moments for each of you to wrap up. Kurt, you're hoping this passes. Are you thinking it's going to pass this fall?
Well, I tend to be a bit of a pessimist. I think that there's a lot of politics infecting this. I think that Congress does not, or at least the House of Representatives, does not want to give the president a major victory, and this would be a major victory on the eve of the 2020 presidential election. But I'm hoping that logic prevails because I think that the opposition is largely political as opposed to economic. To me, this just makes sense. This continues the good relationship that we've had with Canada and Mexico, allows us to continue to grow it. And as I said, it allows us to make and grow things here and sell it over there. And that's what I think we all want.
And David, are you hopeful that some of the changes you're hoping for will end up coming out of the process?
We are. We're keeping our fingers crossed. The Fair Trade Coalition, which includes not only unions but also family, farm, and environmental groups, is hopeful that the negotiations that are going on in Washington will result in the kind of changes we've been talking about here. It's possible that if that doesn't happen, we will certainly organize to the very best of our ability to make sure that there is not a vote, it doesn't get passed the way it is. And if that means that we have to wait until after the elections next year, so be it. Let's get it right this time.
David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Kurt, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
I've been talking to Kurt Bauer from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and David Newby with the Wisconsin Fair Trade Coalition talking about the trade deal between the United States, Mexico, and Canada waiting for ratification in the legislatures in the U.S. and Canada. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the stock market's bouncing around. There's an inverted yield curve in the bond market. We'll find out what that means and what to watch out for in the economic future. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, burnout is a big problem at American workplaces, leading to concerns about high turnover. Kate and her guests look at the problem and possible solutions, and you can share your experiences at work. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, 50 years ago today, the Woodstock Music Festival kicked off. We'll find out what archaeologists working at the Woodstock site are learning. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.